Take your Bibles and turn to Luke chapter 16. While you're doing that, let me say just a word or two. The next gospel meeting that I have scheduled to be away is March 18. I'll be here for almost 5 months. I want us to consider, as we've talked about in the business meeting, a meeting here the first Sunday in March. I'd like to conduct a meeting here before the Easter season and preach some lessons on the restoration, on the unique nature of the church, and on the subject of fellowship. I think we need a series of lessons on that, and perhaps we can get some people from other congregations to come. We've got plenty of time to talk about that. I'm looking forward to being with you. When I began my work at the 1st of November last year, I was with you 4 months before I started the meetings. I've had 17 meetings this year when I finish Wednesday night. But I've been able to be back here for 6 of those on Sunday night, so it's made it a little easier than I thought it was going to be. And at this point, I have 13 meetings scheduled next year to be away 11 Sundays. And I may be able to be here some of those Sunday nights also. I'm looking forward to the next few months. I think we have begun to see some progress. And I believe we can make more progress. And we'll be talking about ways to do that. And I hope that each one of you will be dedicated to that. Several years ago, I heard someone make a statement that caught my attention. He said, "There will be no atheist in hell." And it took me a little while to put that in focus. What he meant by that statement was that after the judgment, there will be no atheist. Everybody will believe at that point. It'll be too late for them, but they will be believers in God at that point. That caused me to do some thinking, and I began to develop a lesson. In fact, I developed a lesson years ago, and as I began to develop this one, I couldn't find that outline, so I don't remember exactly what was in it. On things in hell that I wish were in the church. Now, I know that's an unusual title. You may remember back a few weeks ago, I preached a lesson on things and denominations that I wish were in the church. And the one thing that we need to understand is that you can find lessons even in negative circumstances. When everything is not right, there may be something that's right. And perhaps we can learn something from almost anybody if we would stop and look at it. I want to show you tonight from Luke 16 about 8 different things that are mentioned in this setting in hell that I believe we need in the church. The story is rather familiar in Luke 16, beginning at verse 19 and going through the rest of the chapter. There was a certain rich man, verse 19, and there was a certain beggar called Lazarus in verse 20. There's been a lot of discussion as to whether this is a real story or a parable. And you'll hear people read this many times and talk about parables. And usually if we're studying parables, there'll be a lesson on this. It doesn't really make any difference as far as the final outcome is concerned, whether it's a parable or whether it's a real thing, because the teaching is there. And if Jesus is using it as a parable, it's still true. I really believe that it's a true story. There are 2 reasons at least that I believe it's a true story. One is that Lazarus is named by name. And parables usually do not name specific peoples. They'll say a man went into a far country or a merchant found the pearl of great price. But here Lazarus is named by name. And I believe there was a certain man named Lazarus. The rich man is not named by name, and there may be a point in that end that we need to name people by name more so when something's good than when it's bad. We have a tendency to do just the opposite. The second reason that I believe that this is a real story has to do with the fact that his brothers were still on earth, and he mentions five brothers. That could be a parable, and the lesson would still be there, but for those reasons, I believe it's a real story, and as I said, it doesn't make any difference as far as the final outcome is concerned. It is true that the hell that is being talked about here in verse 23 is Hades. Most of you, if you're reading from something other than the King James Version, will probably see the word Hades there in that verse, which means it is not the final hell, it is not the final Gehenna, but it is that state of the dead, of the unrighteous, that is called, or the state of all the dead, really, that's being described here, that's called Hades, where there is the righteous, represented by Lazarus in Abraham's bosom, and the unrighteous, represented by the rich man, and the torment where he was. Having said that, I would also say this. The same principles that deal with Hades could be used to deal with Gehenna, the final hell. Because this rich man was in torment where he was, and that's what's talked about as far as the final destination of the unrighteous. And everything that we say tonight about what happened here in the Hadean world on the part of the rich man and Lazarus would apply in the eternity, Lazarus representing the good and the rich man representing the bad. But as we begin to read, particularly in verse 23, you'll notice back in verse 21 and 22 that Lazarus and the rich man both die. It says that Lazarus is carried into Abraham's bosom by the angels. It just simply says the rich man died and was buried. But both of them are found in the Hadean world. Verse 23, in hell he, the rich man, lift up his eyes, being in torments, and seeth Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. Abraham is used here to represent the good people that have died. In a sense, Abraham is called the father of many. And so he is represented in that sense. Lazarus in his bosom indicates that Lazarus is in the appropriate place. In verse 24, he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus, that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. There are four things indicated in that verse that were present here with the rich man in Hades or hell that I think we need in the church. First of all, he recognized authority. Here's a man who probably had been in authority most of his life on this earth, probably was accustomed to telling people what to do and what not to do, where to get on, where to get off. Usually that would be the situation with a man that was as rich as he seems to have been. But now, notice he says, Father Abraham. That word father there is used in the sense of authority. Bible talks about the fathers, the traditions of the fathers. And down through the history of the Old Testament, those who were in authority, those who were the leaders, were many times referred to as the fathers. So he recognizes Abraham and even uses the word father in the sense of authority in that setting. And when he says, send Lazarus, he's putting the responsibility with Abraham, recognizing that he's not in the sending business himself anymore. A man who probably was sending people to do things and telling them what to do, as we said, is now asking that someone else send to help him. And so he recognized authority. We need to recognize authority in the church. Christ is the head of the church. God's word is the guide of the church, and what we do in work and worship and service needs to be done by the authority of God. We need that same recognition that there is authority. When there are elders in a congregation, there is a type of authority that's associated with them. There is a type of authority that's in the home with the leadership of the husband and with the parents rearing the children. And we would be in much better condition today in the church, in our families, in the community, if we recognized and appreciated and respected authority, even in government. We need to recognize authority and respect authority. And so here in this setting in Hades, this man recognized authority. In the second place, he recognized his own problem. He said, "Send Lazarus to help me. I'm in a position where I need help." I suspect and would guess that he had never reached that point in life. He probably had thought that he never needed anybody else's help. There's another rich man that is mentioned in Luke 12 who, you know, had the great harvest and tore down his barns and built other barns. And the indication is that with this great sense of riches, that he certainly would not have looked at himself as having problems. He looked at Lazarus as the man who had the problems in this life. And now he focuses on his own problem. He says, "I am in torment." He recognized that he needed some help. We need to do that in the church. It's easy for me to see your problems and you see mine. And sometimes it seems easy for us to talk about one another's problems. But it's not easy for us to see our own mistakes, to see our own shortcomings, to see our own problems. It's much easier for, especially those of us that preach, to be pointing out what others need to do instead of looking at ourselves. And this is something that we as preachers especially need, to be able to look at ourselves and to see where we need help. And when a person gets to the point in life that he thinks he doesn't need help from anybody, I think he's in a pitiful condition. But I would guess that this rich man was pretty much like that in this life. And now he realizes that he has some problems, and he addresses his own problem. In the third place, he realized that he needed mercy. We need that in the church today. We are concerned, and rightly so, about doing things in the right way. We want to give book, chapter, and verse for everything that we do, and that's right. But I think sometimes as we become so involved in doing the right thing, we may overlook how important the mercy of God is. How much we need the grace of God. How much we need God's mercy. Every one of us who's in the church, every one of us who's here tonight needs the mercy of God. But if we're not careful, we will tend to forget that in the busy affairs of this life. This man at this point says, "Have mercy." He says, "I need mercy. Father Abraham, have mercy on me." Not on somebody else, have mercy. We need to live each day with an attitude that we are at the mercy of God. We are totally dependent upon God. We're not saved by mercy only, by grace only, but our salvation is made possible simply by the mercy and grace of God. And we need to have the same attitude that this man in hell had when he said, "Have mercy on me." And then in the fourth place, indicated in this verse and perhaps magnified in the rest of the chapter, I think this man began to put things in proper focus. Think about all the things that he had had in life. And was even reminded later by Abraham, "Remember, son, that in life you had all the good things and Lazarus the bad, and now he's comforted and you're tormented." He said, "You had all the good things." His life had been filled with things. Probably he had sold himself the line that he needed all of those, and maybe even sold himself the idea that he deserved all of those. But now, notice for what he asked. One drop of water on the tip of his finger. A man who'd had all these things in life now wants one little thing, just one little thing comes to mind. Just enough water that would hold to the tip of one's finger. He put things in proper focus. I wish we could all do that in this life. And I'm not for sure that any of us has accomplished that 100%. As we plan for retirement, as we think about saving for education, if we're not careful, we become servants to some extent to things. And when Jesus was talking about not being able to serve God and mammon at the same time, he had this in mind. If you and I would sometime take the calendar and the checkbook and look at it and see where we spend our time and our money, we have a tendency to concentrate on things. Paul warned the church at Corinth, it's the things that are not seen that are important. The things that are seen are temporary, but the things that are not seen are eternal. Last few verses of 2 Corinthians 4. I suspect at this point that this rich man understood that. He didn't have any of the things that he depended on in life with him. And he is so much in torment and so much at the mercy of God that he'd just like to have one drop of water. He put things in proper focus. Then look at verse 25. Abraham said, "Son, remember that thou in thy lifetime receiveth the good things, and likewise Lazarus the evil things, but now he is comforted and thou art tormented." He said, "Son, remember." One of the scariest things to me in the Bible that describes the eternity of being lost is that the memory will be there. If we could die and have no memory, if we were lost and maybe the torment is there, but there's no memory, I think it would be easier. But you think about, especially the person who's had no time for God in this life, like this man, he dies, and now in the Hadean world, he realizes what the situation is, and he has his memory. That's also a good point when we think about heaven. Although here in this setting, Lazarus was at peace and at rest, but I believe we will have our memory in heaven also. And that's a good thought. But you think about being lost for an eternity and remembering all the opportunities that you had and turned down. Think about the members of the church, in the church. That's our lesson tonight, things in hell that need to be in the church. Think about people in the church who just sort of half-heartedly serve God, do not really put themselves into it, and they go along for years claiming to be Christians and doing very little as Christians. And if they're lost, they'll spend an entire eternity remembering the opportunities that they had. Think about the people that, this is a little bit off the subject of the church, but think about the people who've never become Christians. I've been associated with people that have heard the gospel preached for 50 or 60 years. They've stood through an invitation song hundreds, even thousands of times. They've had people encourage them and persuade them to be Christians and have never become Christians. They'll have to remember that for an eternity. There was one man particularly in my home county that was present at the first gospel meeting I ever conducted. I don't remember having a meeting in that general area again after that, but that he was there. As I understand the situation, he went to the services of the church every Lord's Day, maybe every service, never obeyed the gospel. I was called back for his funeral. That wasn't an easy funeral to conduct. And you just think about a man like that, being lost, being in a condition like this rich man, and having to remember 50, 60, 70 years of the invitation being extended and turned it down. Opportunities to serve as a Christian and turned it down. We need to whet our memories just a little bit in the church and do a better job remembering while we're alive so that we won't have to remember the evil things after we're gone. Then look at verse 26. Beside all this, between us and you, there is a great gulf fixed, so that they that would pass from hence to you cannot, neither can they pass to us that would come from thence. Look at the permanence that's in hell. When one dies, his destiny is sealed. Hebrews 9:27, it is appointed unto man once to die, and after that the judgment. Here's a setting where we have a good man who's died and an evil man who's died. I don't know for sure whether there were two specific departments or places as much as there's two specific conditions. I don't know how God takes care of the souls of the departed one. He does take care of them. He reveals to us enough to know that the righteous dead are at peace and rest in his keeping and the unrighteous dead are not. But I don't know exactly how God does that, but at least the condition is there. Here is the condition of Lazarus where he's died in the Lord. Blessed are the dead that die in the Lord, Revelation 14:13. Here's the condition of this man in the Hadean world who's died outside of the right relationship with God. And Abraham says, son, remember that there's a great gulf between us, and that gulf represents that there cannot be any change after death. So when one leaves this life, wherever he goes, it's permanent, never changing. We need to go into Christ with the idea that it's going to be a permanent relationship. We need to go into other relationships in life with the attitude of it being permanent. In our relationship with God, we know that He'll never change. We know that Christ will never change. And so if we have the attitude that this is going to be a permanent relationship, then it will be that kind of relationship. You see, there are some decisions that, in a sense, I made October the 19th, 1953. That was my spiritual birthday. That was the day I was baptized into Christ. I'm sure I didn't understand these things as well then as I do now, but there is a sense in which I made the decision that day that I'm going to worship God permanently. I'm going to be a Christian permanently. I'm going to serve my Lord permanently. That's the attitude that we need to have in the church. Person becomes a Christian, he ought to have the attitude, I'm becoming a Christian, and I'm a Christian the rest of my life. That decision is made today. I'm going to be a Christian the rest of my life. Make mistakes? Yes. Have to straighten out some of them? Yes. Have to make some changes? Yes. But as far as being a Christian, I'm determined that I'm going to be a Christian. I'm going to have that permanent relationship with Jesus Christ. Do you realize how much time gospel preachers have to spend trying to beg those that are already Christians to be Christians? Our main work ought to be taking the gospel to those that don't know it. But I'll guarantee you, if you take the gospel preachers in this county that are full-time, as we say, and you were to analyze their work, that more of their work is done trying to please and satisfy and encourage and get people who ought to be permanently committed to Jesus Christ to be involved in the work of the church. I wish we had the kind of permanence in the church that this rich man had in hell. There was no change after that. It was sealed. It's going to be from then on. And that's the kind of relationship we need with Christ. Then look at verses 27 and 28. He said, I pray thee, therefore, Father, that thou wouldest send him to my father's house. For I have five brothers, that he may testify unto them, lest they also come into this place of torment. We don't have a complete detail given, but don't you think that he probably didn't have much concern for his five brothers while he was alive? At least nothing is mentioned about them in his life while he was still living. I don't know whether they were rich also or not, but he hadn't had nothing said about his concern for his brothers, but now all of a sudden he is concerned about somebody else. He doesn't want his brothers to suffer the way he's suffering. And so he becomes concerned about others. You see why I say there are things in hell that need to be in the church? This is what we need in the church. You read the 12th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and the entire chapter basically is talking about the members of the body and how they fit together. And one member doesn't say to another member, I don't need you. And those that seem to be the least important parts sometimes are the most important parts in the physical body. He says this is the way the church is. And he goes ahead and says that we need to share with one another and we need to care for one another. This rich man was concerned about his family at this point. May not have been concerned about them before. He was concerned about their spiritual welfare at this point. He said, I don't want them to come to this place. Send Lazarus so that he can teach them and they can make some changes so they won't come where I am. We need that same kind of concern for others in the church. And then as you look at all of this, all the verses that we have mentioned and on down, the rest of it is Abraham saying, well, if I sent somebody from the dead, they wouldn't listen to them. If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, if somebody came from the dead, they wouldn't listen to them. But if you look at this overall picture of the rich man in Hades, I think here is the one point that I see that to me sort of stands out above all the others. And something that I need in the work of the church, and perhaps you do too. This rich man finally realized that he could not control everything. Generally speaking, a person who's very rich thinks he's in control. He can buy whatever he needs. He can tell anybody he wants to what to do. He's the one that can control any situation. And usually we'll say, well, I'll just buy it. Just whatever it is, I'll just buy it. I've got the money, I'll buy it. He realizes now that he's not in control. That God is in control. Represented by Abraham, he's the one he's appealing to. He realizes that he can't do anything about his brothers that are back on earth. That he's not the one that can do that. That's one of the hardest lessons in life to learn. We allow ourselves to get to thinking, well, I'm big enough that I can control anything. I've got everything I need. I can control the situation. And then there are things that happen that teach us that we're not in control. Judy's illness and death did more to teach me that than anything's ever happened to me. When you stand in a hospital room, looking outside at the day of the flood in May of last year, and realize that there is not a thing that you can do, and maybe not a thing that any doctor can do. It's a humbling experience, and it gets you to realizing how much you depend on God and how little you are in control. We get to thinking we're important. We can do these things. I've always been big and strong and thought I could just do about anything that I needed to. But there comes a time when you can learn, and I hope I'm in the process of continuing to learn that I'm not in control, that God is. And this rich man didn't learn that until it was too late. That's why I'm saying we need these things in the church. I realize that this is a little bit of an unusual lesson. I'm sure when I announced it, you thought that. But here's what I'm saying. In this setting of the rich man in the Hadean world, he recognized the importance of authority. He recognized his own problem. He saw the need for mercy to him. He put things in focus for perhaps the first time. He was in a permanent situation. He had his memory, and he used that memory. He had concern for others, and he realized that he couldn't control everything. And I believe if we will take those points that we see in that setting in the Hadean world and bring them over into the work of the church, that each one of them can be helpful to us in doing the work of the Lord. And the first thing that we need to do is to be sure that we do what he wanted to happen to his five brothers. He wanted them to get right with the Lord at the time that he mentions them. And that's what we need to do tonight. Nothing else really matters if we're not right with the Lord. Things can happen so soon. We're seeing that all around us as we look at those that we're losing and things that are happening. So be sure that you have your life right with God, and if it's not, then come to Christ as together we stand and sing.
Turn not away.